Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 179 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. This week we are talking all about Ferdinand Piëch. He is the car industry titan who was responsible for the Porsche 917, the Bugatti Veyron, the Audi Quattro, the VW Phaeton, all sorts of others. He transformed the fortunes of Audi and of Volkswagen. He's part of the Porsche dynasty, that family. His is an extraordinary tale. Now, from time to time, we pick one individual, one of these just incredible characters from the car industry, and do a full episode on them. Most recently, it was Colin Chapman, episode 167, if you want to go back and listen to our podcast on the Lotus founder. But this time, it's Ferdinand Piëch. I hope you enjoy listening. Before we get started, I will remind you to rate and review the podcast. Please do that. And however you're listening to the podcast, please just very quickly subscribe or follow. Hit the follow button or the subscribe button. It really, really helps us. Okay, let's get stuck in to this episode. Ferdinand Carl Piëch, born 17th of April 1937, died quite recently, actually 25th of August 2019. But we've chosen him, Andrew, because he is, goodness me, a fascinating character, one of these titans of the car industry. And you can look at him in so many different ways. His achievements were fantastic. He had some fairly epic failures.
But he failed for the right reasons. Even his failures were good failures.
He sort of failed upwards, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
And a very tricky character, by the sounds of it. Anyone who knew him or spent time with him says so. And also part of the Porsche dynasty. It's like he was scripted.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking when we decided to do this, I was mindful. My mind went back to that brilliant two-part piece Mel Nichols did for us about Bob Lutz.
Yeah.
And his extraordinary contribution to the car industry in the late 20th and early 21st century. But Piëch's bigger than that, isn't he? I mean, in terms of the influence that he's had on the global car industry. So, I mean, you could say Enzo Ferrari, but, you know, Enzo Ferrari created one company which has never sold very many cars. Mm. You know, Piëch not only, well, we'll get into the things he did in racing, I'm sure, but he also, you know, saved Volkswagen and turned it into this colossal, the largest car company on earth. Mm. No one, surely, in terms of his influence on the business that, you know, for which we're all, you know, earn our livings, is bigger or greater or more interesting or important than Piëch.
That's right, and that's why he's such a fascinating subject for a podcast like this.
Yeah.
He was born in Vienna, Austria, so he was an Austrian.
Yes.
And he was the grandson of Ferdinand Porsche.
Yeah.
The great engineer who created the original Volkswagen Beetle, Auto Unions, 1930s Grand Prix cars. And so he is one of these very rare guys, but there are a few of them. as part of the Porsche dynasty, who was associated or connected to the companies that they worked in and ultimately led by blood. They were in the families.
Yeah. People forget. I mean, he is as much a Porsche as Ferry Porsche.
Yeah.
It's only because, you know, Ferdinand had a son and a daughter. He may have had more, but he had Ferry, and he also had Louise, who married a banker called Piëch.
Yeah. Yeah. Anton Piëch,
so, So, you know, so Ferdinand Piëch's mother was Louise Porsche.
Absolutely a Porsche.
He is a pure Porsche, yeah.
And actually, so was it nepotism that allowed him to rise through the ranks of the companies that he worked in? I mean, it must have helped. Crucially, being a Porsche gave him authority and probably confidence to make big decisions, make big changes.
Yeah, I don't think confidence was anything he was ever particularly lacking.
No.
I don't think that he was one of those guys who kind of like struggled when he got up in the morning and said, oh, I'm not sure I should say this. I think he was always fairly sure of his ground.
But maybe that comes through his breeding, you know, as part of the Porsche family. You're fairly untouchable, aren't you? But yet you have to balance that out with the fact that he was a great engineer, a visionary engineer. You know, he wasn't a chancer who blagged his way along in life on the strength of his name.
No.
He was brilliant.
He was absolutely anything but the sort, somebody who just used family connections to get on in the world.
Mm.
You know, I think that if a person that talented, and the other thing was, you need two things, don't you? You need to be talented and you need to be driven.
Yeah.
And you need, well, three things, and you need also not to be, you know, not to be worried about what people think about you. There's a wonderful quote, wasn't it? My desire for harmony is limited.
There you go.
That's
from his autobiography.
Yeah, as it says it all. So, I mean, if you've got that, if you just don't care, you can do anything, can't you?
Imagine
you can say anything to anyone,
are.
And you just don't care, and it must be so liberating. I'm not sure that necessarily makes you a particularly nice person, but you know, we're not here to discuss his attributes in that respect. We're just here to, you know, to talk about his contribution to this industry. And you know, if you really, really don't care what people think about you, you know, that's a massive, massive strength, isn't it?
It really is. Okay, so I'm going to trot through his career, just that people know exactly what we're talking about, what kind of guy we're dealing with, and then we'll get into the specifics. So he studied mechanical engineering, and he started working at Porsche in 1963. Do you know, he was actually only there for 8 years. But during that time, he led the development of the 917, which we'll come on to. He then, in the early 70s, moved to Audi. He was engineering chief and then chief executive from 1988 until 1993, when he left for the VW Group, so overseeing the group as a whole, and he was ultimately chairman of the company's supervisory board. So he was the big boss, and he wielded unusual power and influence, actually, in every role that he ever held. Those are the Porsche, Audi, and then all of VW Group. They were really the three big roles that he held, and we have to go back to Porsche, which is as a young engineer, where he really started making a name for himself, as if he didn't already have enough of one. And his first big win, really, was the 917, wasn't it?
Yeah, but he'd been involved before that. You know, I know that he was, and I don't know whether this was as a consultant or it must have been before he technically arrived there, but he was the bloke who said the flat sticks shouldn't have a wet sump engine. Because if it had a wet sump engine, you get oil surge, and if you got oil surge, it'd be fine on the road, but it meant you couldn't race it. So that flat six came to market with a dry sump engine. 911 started racing then. Just imagine how different the history of that company, and frankly, the history of racing would be if 911 never raced. And then he was, you know, he was involved. You know, he was fairly instrumental in the creation of the Berg Spider too.
Yes.
This 385, this was 1968, so this was pre-917, this 385 kilo car with its beryllium brakes and all the insanity that went into it. I think I'm right. Wasn't it cooled by dry ice because it didn't need a radiators or anything else, because it was just a hill climb car, so it would never need to and it had all these other, you know, it didn't have a fuel pump because it had a pressurized fuel tank. It was just a really, really clever car. And then, as you say, yeah, the 917.
I mean, that we could, maybe we've even done it actually, an episode entirely on the 917, because it's a hell of a tale. But I mean, fundamentally, it was the car that earned Porsche its first outright victory at Le Mans and its second, first in 1970, again in 1971.
Yeah.
But what are the sort of highlights of the 917? I mean, it was led, the engineering of that car was led by Ferdinand Piëch. But the rules around sports car racing at that time, they were structured in such a way that a car company would have to build what was thought to be a prohibitive number of cars to satisfy the regulations. And it was Piëch and Porsche who just said, okay, well, let's build them. Let's build the 25 cars that we have to make, and then we can build this monstrous machine.
So the history of it goes back to, you know, Ford winning Le Mans with these 7-litre monsters in 1966 and 1967. And the speeds were getting ridiculous and it was all getting a bit out of hand. So the FIA just said, okay, no more prototypes. If you're gonna do a car which you want to race at the top level, you've got to build 25 of them, knowing that nobody would.
Yeah.
and lo and behold, they did. And, you know, there's that famous photograph, isn't it, of 25 917s all lined up at Weissach for inspection. You know, little did the inspector know that, I don't know how many of them were actually properly built. I mean, I think almost all of them had to be dismantled and put back together again, because basically they were just a collection of parts which had been turned into something which looked like a 917. But, yeah. And then the rest of it... And I said this before about Porsche engineering. What was so remarkable about it was how unremarkable they were. You know, this was a time when, you know, Lola had been using monocoque chassis in sports cars for years. I mean, Jaguar had used them in the 50s. Porsche stayed with the space frame. They had quite slow, clunky synchromesh gearboxes. The air-cooled engines really, really limited what they could get in terms of power. You couldn't have a four-valve per cylinder head. Whereas if you use water, then you could have done so. They didn't have that, and yet they got more power from an air cooled 4.5 liter flat 12 than Ferrari could get from a water cooled 5 liter V12. And the cars were lighter, quicker, better, faster, everything you like. Despite the fact that there was technically nothing particularly clever on them. They just took everything, particularly lightness, to the ultimate extreme. That is what is so remarkable about those cars, is that there was so little. There was no revolution about those cars at all. They were just unbelievably good, quite conventional cars.
It's hard to understand how that even happened in the first instance. I mean, Porsche, had it been racing in the top category at Le Mans before, or was the 917... really its first attempt?
Well, it had been racing in the top category at Le Mans, but only because the top category was basically a 3-litre category. So what they'd said was, if you want a car, a prototype, it's got to be 3 litres or less. And that's why the GT40 won in 1968 and 1969, because, you know, they made stacks of GT40s, sold them to customers. So what you could do then is, you could, if you built more than this 25, then you could have... a 5-litre engine, and off you go. That was the GT40. But Porsche hadn't got that, so they had the 908, which came within 100 yards of winning Le Mans in 1969, and should have won it in 1968. Yeah, they'd had lots of goes. You know, they had won... You know, the 908 won every single other major sports car race by that time. It had won the Targa Florio, it had won the Daytona 24 Hours... it had won the Nürburgring 1000 case. Every single major sports car race had been won by a 3-litre Porsche, but not the one that they really, really wanted. And even the 917 failed at the first attempt in 69. It led for 21 hours with our mate Richard Atwood and Vic Elford driving it. And then it broke when it was, I can't remember how many laps it was in the lead, but it had an insuperable advantage over everything else. And then, it broke. So, and then after that, they never looked back.
So Piëch was in his early 30s when he led the development of the 917, which is just amazing, actually. But actually, what I really want to know is, how did Ferrari allow itself to be beaten by a relative upstart in Porsche? Okay, you know, it didn't have Ferrari's legacy, and this 30-something-year-old engineer.
Do you know what? I'm glad you asked. there were a couple of reasons. Firstly, Ferrari, like everybody else, didn't see the 917 coming.
Yeah.
And so Ferrari's response to it, the 512S, was a compromised car. They actually, what is sad about that particular story is, they did finally do the car the 512S should always have been, and it was called the 512M, the Modificato. But because that, so they produced that car right at the end of 1970, when it was meant to have raced as a works car in 1971. But by then, the FIA got wise to what Porsche were up to, and they said, right, for 1972, there's a blanket 3 litre limit. And Ferrari thought, well, what's the point of, you know, of racing this 5 litre car when we know we're going to have to go to 3 litres in 1972? So the 512M was basically just used by a very small number of privateer cars. But there was one race at the end of 1970 it did, and it blew the 917s away. But anyway, so to answer your question, so that's one top, but they were rushed into it. The other problem that Ferrari had, and it was a unique problem for Ferrari, and I think it changed the way that people have gone racing almost ever since, certainly until the present day, is Ferrari was fighting on two fronts. They were trying to maintain top-level presence in both Formula One and sports car racing. And their resources, their financial resources and their talent resources were just hopelessly divided. And I think probably the 917 was the car which made Ferrari realise that they couldn't fight on all fronts. So they did do it, you know, 1972, 1973 with the 312 PB, their last great successful sports car. But they were hopeless in Formula One then. So that's it. I think it's those two factors. They didn't see it coming and they were trying to do too many things with their resources.
Yeah. So the 917, yeah, fascinating. A really successful racing car and just brilliantly executed, but nothing on it really that was fantastically innovative or, you know, no groundbreaking new technologies, really.
No.
It's just a beautifully done car.
Just a beautifully done, incredibly light, very slippery. I mean, you know, the aero was very challenging on it. As we know, 1969, it was, you know, Richard Aplett famously said it went from, you know, over the winter of 1969 to 1970, it went from the worst car he'd ever driven to the best.
Yeah.
just because, you know, they were just pushing the envelope on aero, on the, you know, on the, just trying to get the drag coefficient as low as humanly possible, and the car just wasn't stable. But they sorted that out. But no, it had, you know, it had sort of polyester bodywork. It had a tubular space frame, two valves per cylinder engine. No miracles there. It was only really when they went to Can-Am and they turbocharged it. That was pretty cutting edge then to have turbo racing cars. But that's, you know, that was something completely different. And that wasn't, that was, in fact, I think that happened after Piëch had left. I think he'd already buggered off to Audi by then.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking now about his big achievement, his sort of crowning glories. And the 917 is certainly one of them. And I guess the Audi Quattro is another, only a few years later.
Can we talk about the 100, which predated the Quattro?
Yeah. Oh, if it came first, yeah.
Yeah. Predated the Quattro. You know, that was the first Audi with a five-cylinder engine.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, you just, you know, the idea of a five-cylinder engine was just bizarre because it was apparently impossible to balance. Well, they found a way and they created this amazing engine with this wonderful soundtrack. And they put it in the most aerodynamic car that had ever been built. The original Audi 100, I think it used to have its drag coefficient and like a sticker in one of the in a rear quarter light or something. It used to say CD 0.30 or whatever because it was so slippery. And you know, and the thing was that Audi in the 1970s was a complete nothing company.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, we think of Audi today and, you know, we kind of think of the premium German mass market manufacturers and think, oh, BMW, Audi, Mercedes.
They're on a level up then.
Yeah. Yeah, wasn't like that then at all. And it was Piëch who started that process.
Yeah.
With cars like the Audi 100, which was beautiful and clever and innovative. And then let's get on to the Quattro because that was the next thing he did, which was groundbreaking and to an extent changed the way that people thought about sports cars. Certainly changed the way people thought about how to go rallying.
Yeah. Oh, goodness me. So, yeah, I mean, four-wheel drive, we're talking late 1970s now, four-wheel drive used on maybe farm equipment.
Land Rovers.
Military machinery, Land Rovers. Yeah, it was...
Okay, I've got to do my usual shout-out here.
Yes, I know. I knew that was coming.
Jensen FF, sorry. But that was like a flash in the pan. 1968, we didn't win that. Yeah, I think so. Anyway, yeah. But yes, absolutely. Yeah,
but I mean, it Jensen... certainly wasn't used on sort of, absolutely, you know, upmarket road cars or performance cars, was it?
No, not at all.
But it's funny because the benefits seem obvious. The traction benefits of driving all four wheels rather than just the front or the rear wheels, it doesn't take any great leap of imagination to realise that there would be a benefit there. Mm. But it did take a handful of engineers led by PIEC to actually make it happen on an upmarket performance road car.
I think, and someone will far cleverer and better informed than me will tell us why it was, I think that there was a technical challenge. I think it was for some reason really difficult to do a high performance. Maybe it was refinement, something like that.
Yes.
With the transfer from, you know, the power from the front to the back and to the front. And, you know, directing, you've got an engine, a longitudinal engine with a gearbox at the back. So the power comes out the back of the gearbox, which is in the middle of the car. You then got to get it back to the front of the car and rearward. So, I mean, it's not a nothing thing to do.
No.
But he did it.
They did it. They made it work. And so the Audi Quattro road car, I mean, I drove one a few years ago, actually. And it's,
what do you think?
I love driving it because it's a different generation. It's a significant car. But you wouldn't choose one to blast over a mountain road. It's a sort of understeery, fairly numb kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, they did get a lot better because I think the early cars had like a fixed 50-50 torque split and then they got a torsion centre differential and then they obviously got the 20-valve engine. And so the last ones were massively better than the first. But yes, they still were fundamentally imbalanced. They had, you know, I think the entire engine was slung out in front of the front wheels. They had quite a lot of turbo lag. But they caught a moment, didn't they? And they became incredibly popular.
Well, they did. And also, they just changed rallying for good. Absolutely transformed that form of motorsport. The Quattros came along. And, I mean, we don't need to go into all the details. But they revolutionised rallying, won the championship, won multiple championships, lots and lots of rallies. And they made rear-wheel drive totally outmoded in rally competition. And everybody had to follow suit. Everybody else involved in rallying at that time, if they wanted to be competitive, had to build a four-wheel drive car. And that's because of the Quattro.
So what was the last successful rear drive rally car? Was it a Mark II Escort or an O37?
Probably a Lancia O37, yeah.
Yeah.
That was still winning rallies while the Quattro was around.
But presumably only on tarmac, not anywhere where traction was needed.
There might have been a couple of outliers, but more or less I'm sure that's the pattern, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then even Lancia followed the O37 up with four-wheel drive cars. It was just proven that that was the way you had to go.
It changed everything, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did. Yeah. And again, PIEC right at the heart of it. And it was a very small skunk works operation, really, to begin with. Just a handful of engineers building and testing this thing before they presented it to anybody at the Volkswagen board. It might well be the case that if it was a bigger sort of above board project, it would have been deemed too costly or too expensive or the benefits too vague. I don't know. But because it was done in a skunk works kind of way, just a small hardcore of really dedicated, skilled engineers led by PIEC, they were able to make something of it. And goodness me. Well, Audi, for one thing, it built its brand really on four wheel drive, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Quattro, you know, you still get it on the cars today, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. And that is a huge part of
actually,
Audi,
you know,
I've
spent the last few days tooling about in an R8, and it's so remarkable that it doesn't have four wheel drive that they've actually put a badge saying rear wheel drive on the car. The brand is now so indelibly associated with four wheel drive that when they do a performance car which doesn't have it, they feel the need to say so.
They do. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And weirdly, and perhaps awkwardly for Audi, it's probably more fun than the four-wheel drive ones.
Definitely. We're not going to get diverted by this, but a nice stock standard, which is what I've got, base model rear drive R8, is just, it's lovely.
Yeah.
It's just a really, really nice thing to tool about in. So lovely and usable and livable and fast and fun. And yeah, anyway, not what we're here to talk about.
So Audi built its brand on four-wheel drive. It was during that period that it became a proper credible alternative to VW, Mercedes and to BMW. And again, PIEC was central to all of that, Audi becoming what it is today.
I mean, he did things like, you know, I remember when this car was new, the Audi V8.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of Audi doing a luxury saloon, and it was just laughed at. And, you know, and the Audi V8, it wasn't a great car, but it was kind of like a practice car because that paved the way for the A8. It just really hauled that brand up market and made people think that's okay, so that's what an Audi should be. That's how we should be thinking of Audi. It was transformative.
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, turning Audi around, goodness me, that's one of his achievements. And it was after his spell at Audi that he went to the VW Group. And this is when VW was struggling enormously. I've been doing some research and multiple sources have said that the company was 3 months away from going bankrupt.
I was going to say days. Yeah, it really was. It was absolutely on its own.
Blimey. And Piet came in and turned it around. And so he did some very pragmatic things right away, like switching the factories from 5 days to 4 day weeks, negotiated hard with suppliers to drive down costs, and started implementing the product strategy across multiple different brands that continues basically to underpin the VW Group nowadays, using one platform across multiple different brands to build several different cars.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't the first person to do it by any means. Do you remember, you were just born. But there was the Type 4 group of cars, so an Alfa 164, a Fiat Croma, Lancia, Tamer, and a Saab 9000. In the late 1980s, were all built on the same platform. But he took that concept and just ran so much further and faster with it. And what he realised is that, you know, whereas, you know, the Saab and the Audi and the Lancia and so on and so forth could all have, you know, their own suspension systems and their own engines and, you know, and they just used, you know, a base commonality. I can remember I did a group test between a Golf, a Leon, an Octavia and an Audi A3. Yep. And they were all 2 litre diesels. And we parked them up and lifted the bonnet. And I just amused myself for a while trying to find a clip, anything, which wasn't in exactly the same place and wasn't precisely the same component used on all of them. And they were literally the same car wearing different clothes. Mm. So, you know, their bodywork was different. And I think they used to say, which I don't know whether it was PR or true, but, we can set up the suspension any way we like. That was true, maybe it wasn't. But, you know, maybe they could control the tyre pressures, maybe their spring rates, that sort of thing. But basically, the cars were identical.
Mm.
And the economies of scale, basically, you only have to design one car and you get four, which you can sell through four different manufacturers. It was genius.
And I bet there would have been some who would look at that strategy and go, well, you're cannibalising your own sales. You know, how can you have a Skoda cannibalising sales perhaps from an Audi? It's the same car underneath. It trades for much less money.
Yeah.
And Piëch and the people around him weren't bothered by that at all. Their view was, it doesn't matter if they're buying a Skoda or an Audi or VW or a Seat. They're buying from the VW group.
Yeah, I think he also, but I think they also thought that internal competition was good. And I think they also thought that, you know, there are any number of people who probably think, oh, I should buy a Skoda because it's the same car and it's cheaper. But I don't want to have to tell my neighbour why I've got a Skoda and he or she's got an Audi. And whereas other people would just think, who'd spend all that extra money on an Audi when So I think the only one which he never really got right with Seat. I never really knew what a Seat was, what a Seat was for. I understood exactly what a Volkswagen and an Audi and a Skoda. I think what they did with Skoda. Oh my goodness. When I got in this business. And it was, you know, Skoda 130 Rapids and that sort of thing. Dreadful cars. and you know what they did with that, and then establishing Skoda as a high quality but value proposition. So he still, you know, they were the same cars, but that didn't mean everybody had the same reason to buy one or to want one. And I think they appealed to different constituencies. And so, you know, they weren't stealing sales from others because they were actually selling to different people. I think it was profoundly clever.
Hi everyone, Dan here with a message from one of our partners. I'll be quick. Now, if Ferdinand Piëch was still with us today, do you think he would knock about online without protecting his devices using a VPN? No, of course he wouldn't. He was far too bright for that. Many of us know what it's like to have our details or passwords stolen while we're online. VPNs, or virtual private networks, protect you from that. If, like me, you travel a lot with work and you find yourself logging onto hotel or airport Wi-Fi networks, you could be at risk of this happening to you. We've partnered with NordVPN to offer our listeners 4 months free when you buy a 2-year plan. And you can get a 5th month free by using our exclusive link, nordvpn.com/intercooler, or you can click the link in the description of this podcast. That's 5 extra months completely free. How many of us use the same password for everything, maybe with 1 or 2 subtle differences for different websites and so on? Yeah, I know. That means we're playing with fire, but a VPN can protect us from hackers and scammers. NordVPN, that's NordVPN, offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can try NordVPN for yourself risk-free. Head to nordvpn.com/intercooler to get 5 months free of charge. That's nordvpn.com/intercooler, or click the link in the description of this podcast and be like Ferdinand Piëch. Protect yourself online.
So with that kind of strategy, he saved VW itself, but then just made the VW group as a whole one of the world's biggest car makers, or the biggest. It's hard to know quite how you count these things.
Yeah, but no, generally, I think it's generally regarded, when you, it depends whether you regard it by turnover or by profit or by number of cars you make, and it changes from year to year. But yeah, I think absolutely one of, if not the.
And it's Piëch's ambition that expanded the VW group wildly. So downwards, buying Skoda, as we've said, and turning that around into the group's value brand.
Yeah.
And upwards as well, by buying Bentley, Lamborghini, Bugatti.
Yeah.
Goodness me.
And so clever with it, because he also identified that, I mean, who'd have thought before Piëch that you could put a Bentley and a Volkswagen on the same platform?
Yeah.
He created these. And you know, he took a company like Bentley, which was terribly underinvested. It was this little cottage industry in Crewe, making 1,000 cars a year, and you know, completely transformed it into, you know, one of the most profitable, coveted, desirable car manufacturers on earth.
So we'll come back to the Bentley tale in a little bit, because it's an interesting story, that one. But let's do the Bugatti Veyron quickly, because that, as much as anything, embodies Piëch's, the scale of his ambition.
Yeah.
And it's as though he was determined that his company, the VW Group as a whole, should be regarded as capable of doing just about anything within automotive. So it should build the most efficient cars on one hand. You know, the VW XL1, that little thing that did supposedly 285 miles per gallon or whatever it was.
Yes, exactly right, yeah.
The one-litre
car.
And then, you know, from tiny little city cars up to big luxury cars, and then the world's most powerful production car, the Veyron, 1,000 horsepower, quad-turbo W16 engine, four-wheel drive.
8 litres.
DSG, goodness me.
Yeah.
I wonder, though, to what extent Piëch was driven by his ambition and his ego. There's no doubt that he was, but you have to kind of look at the results and go, well, if these were as a result of his ego, you can't really argue with that too much, can you? Because it's astonishing what he was able to achieve.
It is. I think that cars like that, I think he built certain cars because people had said to him, you can't do that. That's not possible. You can't. And sometimes he'd do it and it wouldn't work. You know, for instance,
Somebody
would have said to him, you cannot build a Volkswagen to rival a Mercedes S-Class because it's a Volkswagen.
Mm.
And he just went, I'll show you.
Mm.
And he built the Phaeton, which was, in its own way, every bit as good, as certainly as well-engineered and as robust and as quiet and as comfortable as an S-Class. But it was still a Volkswagen, and people didn't want it. And I think the Veyron is another one. I think it was just him going, I'll show you. You know, you can't do a 1,000 horsepower car. Oh, yeah, you can. You know, if you think that back in the day when, you know, the McLaren F1 had 627 horsepower, and he was talking about 1,000. Okay, it's a little bit later, but not a huge amount. And, you know, it had this incredibly delayed, tortured gestation, all sorts of problems. There were accidents, and the car's design evolved, and it changed, and this, that, and the other. But they stuck with it, and they created, you know, somebody told me that they lost over $1 million on every one that they made. I don't know whether that's true or not. I wouldn't be surprised. But again, you know, what they were left with at the end of the day was a brand which, you know, the very, very wealthy kind of have to have.
Bugatti even now can charge as much or more than anyone for a car these days.
Yeah, more. Yeah. And I don't know how the Chiron worked out as a business case, but I imagine it's probably done pretty well for them in a way that the Veyron didn't. And, you know, and that's the other thing about Piëch, is he wasn't afraid to play the long game. You know, he probably realised that when they took on Skoda, this strange Czech company, which didn't have a particularly good, well, you know, its reputation practically was so bad as, you know, people would make jokes about it.
Yeah.
But it fitted in with his vision of what you were saying, of having this all-encompassing car group where, you know, cars, everything from the most exotic supercars known to mankind to just basic quality, affordable transport. You know, frankly, like the cars designed by his grandfather, like the Beetle, and everything in between. And if that took, you know, a decade to change people's perception of Skoda, let it take a decade, because you'll be cashing in for the rest of time. And I think that is so key to understanding what motivated Piëch. He simply wasn't in the, you know, stack 'em high, sell 'em cheap market. And he was, you know, we go on, don't we, about, you know, Bob Lutz being the product guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 2010, Bob Lutz called Piëch the greatest living product guy.
There you go. Well, okay, I didn't know that. But, you know, if it's good, if Bob thinks so, then I'm not going to disagree with him.
He also said he could never have worked for him.
I'm sure that's also true. I don't think that very many people would have chosen to do that. But
yeah.
If you imagine if you'd done that and you'd survived and you kind of grudgingly earned his respect, what an education that would be.
Mm. Yes.
Wouldn't you just love to have been just in some of the engineering meetings?
Yeah. Piëch, one thing that stands out for me is that Piëch was broad-minded. So he wasn't just obsessed with racing cars like a lot of these guys are. You know, he did the 917, clearly loved motorsport, loved racing, but he was interested in all sorts of other stuff. He was interested in the machinations of multinational car companies. He was interested in the most efficient cars going, in luxury cars, lots of mass-market cars produced under his watch. He was simply motivated by excellent engineering.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what, I think probably that's what it comes down to, the success that he had in his career. Also, though, his iron will, he was not one for turning, that man. And also, because of his bloodline, his very unusual influence in the boardroom, all those things made him a formidable character.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, there were some failures. I mean, the Phaeton, that has to be recognised as a failure, certainly
absolute
commercially.
Abject failure.
Yeah. but one compelling thing here is that, you know, the group already had the Audi A8, big luxury sedan.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't worried about launching a new one that would
sit
right
alongside the A8. I can remember at the time thinking, I just don't understand this.
Yeah.
And I still don't really understand why. Because, you know, I can understand why you would, if you had Audi, you create a Skoda to sit in the same sort of, in terms of its sort of size and performance proposition. That, you know, that I understand. I don't understand why you thought people would buy a full-size luxury Volkswagen.
Well, I mean, but you'd be proven right.
Yeah, but you know, I am, but I would have been for once. But he clearly had a plan. It just didn't work.
Yeah, this time. So I went back and read a story that Peter Robinson wrote for the Intercooler on the Phaeton, and he concludes it by saying the Phaeton turned out to be the best engineered failure in motoring history. Its legacy today is to exist as a totem to the unrestrained ego of Ferdinand Piëch, which are fairly punchy words. But the,
hard,
one of the stories,
hard to disagree with them.
I know. One of the stories about the Phaeton, well told, is that Piëch set his engineering team a very specific target. The air conditioning system had to be able to maintain 22 degrees centigrade inside while it was 50 degrees centigrade outside, so roasting hot outside, while being driven all day at 186 miles an hour.
And it didn't matter. Literally, not that it's, and that's not that it would never happen. It could never happen.
No. The car, A, had a limiter, a speed limiter at 155 miles an hour. So it's never going to get up to 186 miles an hour. But but was that a good thing? So he set this outrageous standard for that car. You have to wonder at what cost. At what cost did the engineering team achieve that? I mean, there has to be one.
Well, I mean, absolutely. You know, the very fact that it had to be engineered to do a speed it would never do.
Yeah, that's why.
Is, you know, in terms of, let us, for instance, the tyres that you choose for it. You've got to compromise the tyres. You're going to be adding weight all over the place. You know, you're going to have bigger, heavier brakes. You're going to have bigger, heavier, more robust suspension. You know, you are compromising the car right the way down the line to give it an ability to do something that it's never, ever going to do. Because as you say, it's speed limited. It cannot do it. It's electronically limited, you know, programmed not to do it. I think it's this sense, isn't it, that even though you'll never do it, even though the car is restricted from doing it, it's just that lovely sense of over-engineering. You know that it can.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's the hoary old thing about, you know, people not using their Range Rovers off-road. They don't want to use their Range Rovers off-road, they don't need to. They just love to know that they could and that the car can do it, because it gives them a sense of, you know, engineering integrity, of respect. It's like, you know, anybody stupid enough to have a watch that'll go down to 1,000 meters underwater. You know, why would
you hold your hand up, please?
Yeah, no, I'm not wearing today.
Okay.
You know, why did I get? I got that watch because it was, as far as I could see, the most robust watch that had ever been built. And for the way that I lived my life, that was, I thought, a worthwhile reason for doing it. I just love the fact that even his bad decisions, as I said earlier, were made for sound engineering reasons. He just wanted, in whatever it was, we can talk about the A2.
Oh, we can do. Let me just finish off on the Phaeton, because Peter Robinson remembers asking Piëch directly, what if the engineering team can't deliver on that very specific benchmark that we discussed? And Piëch said, then I will fire them all and bring in a new team. And if they tell me they can't do it, I will fire them too. So, talk about ruthless.
So to him, there was clearly no such thing as impossible.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think that's probably exactly right. And he was cocky enough or confident enough or had enough of an ego to think that he and his engineering teams could figure out anything. We can talk about the A2 in a moment, but we also need to mention Rolls-Royce. If we're discussing his few failures, we need to mention Rolls-Royce.
Yeah.
Because that is a saga, and it's super complicated, actually.
Let's not get into the absolute nitty-gritty of it, because it's,
do we?
No.
But he tried to buy Rolls-Royce for the VW Group.
Well, he sort of, well, yeah. So the important thing to remember is that Rolls-Royce, the company that makes the cars, wasn't Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce is a company in Derby that makes aircraft engines and all sorts of weapon systems and everything else. It licenses it, another company to build cars called Rolls-Royces. And there are various things which go with that license. I think the Parthenon grill went with it, didn't it? And
The Spirit of Ecstasy.
The Spirit of Ecstasy, exactly. Yeah. And that was all part of the deal. And yeah, and so when Vickers, which owned whatever it was called, Rolls-Royce and Bentley Motor Cars, in 1997, put the business up for sale, Piëch wanted it. And he wanted, whatever was said, whatever was spun, whatever was PR, he wanted both. He wanted to build Bentleys and he wanted to build Rolls-Royces. And it ended up not working out that way.
So he, on this one occasion, he did get outmaneuvered by BMW, who ended up with, in some weird roundabout way, the rights to build Rolls-Royce cars.
But what is really interesting about it is, and I think this is sometime where the ego and the arrogance didn't help him. I think, and okay, we're, you know, bringing it with the benefit of hindsight, but if he had looked at the commercial relationship of Rolls-Royce PLC, the aircraft engine company, and BMW, who had had a very long and very fruitful relationship with each other, and it was entirely in Rolls-Royce PLC's gift as to who would have the right to call a car a Rolls-Royce. You know, I don't understand why he thought that was a battle he was ever going to win.
But he didn't really lose, though, did he? Because he came out of it with Bentley and the Crewe factory.
Yeah.
And Bentley's done extraordinary things ever since.
He got absolutely everything apart from the right to call a car Rolls-Royce.
Yeah.
He even got, I think, the Spirit of Ecstasy and the Parthenon Grill. But given that he couldn't put them on a car called Rolls-Royce, maybe he could have called them a Schmoll Schmoyce or something. I don't know. they weren't much good to him. So in the end, I don't know whether he gave them or sold them to... One of the most extraordinary things about that deal, and this has got nothing to do with Piëch, but you know the Silver Ghost, the original Silver Ghost, you know, the most famous, possibly valuable road car in the world, probably the most valuable road car in the world. It appears that Rolls-Royce never realised that BMW never realised that car stayed at Crewe because they never got it. And that car was owned by Bentley. That Rolls-Royce was owned by Bentley for years and years and years. And I think they did let Rolls-Royce use it from time to time. But basically, they missed the Silver Ghost. And it was eventually sold very recently by Bentley to a private owner who you and I know. And Rolls-Royce has never been near it.
Amazing.
They've lost the jewel in their crown.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary.
That is amazing.
Anyway, sorry, I digress again.
So you wanted to mention the A2.
Yeah, only because, I mean, it's like, I guess it's like the Phaeton, it's like the Veyron. It's just another one of these. It's just another fascinating insight into the mind of Piëch. Have you driven one?
No, I haven't actually.
I mean, they're just, I think they look really cool. But they have this aluminium space frame. And, you know, the problem with doing that is, if you're doing volume, I mean, as in proper volume, as in hundreds of thousands of cars, it's very, very difficult to do with an aluminium space frame, which is why cars who have them tend to be, you know, cars like, well, I mean, the A8, certainly, and Ferraris and that sort of thing, which are built in, you know, in very low volumes. And the A2 was Piëch going, we're just going to do a completely different sort of car. We're going to make it all aluminium. It's going to weigh... I think it weighed something like 770 kilos. It was so unbelievably light. But of course, they had to charge an enormous amount of money to get any kind of return on it. I think it only had four seats. It was a really, really good idea in theory, which just didn't stack up at all in practice. I guess like a Phaeton. But there's a bit of me, because, you know, they'll never rust, and so they always look quite good when you see them knocking about these days. Which would quite like an A2. I have no idea what I'd do with it. but as a local smoker, just to stooge about in, I think it'd be quite good fun. But again, it was just another example of Piëch going, don't tell me I can't do that, because I'm going to go and do it.
I want to talk about some of the feuds that he had during his life, often with his own family, proper soap opera stuff. Just extraordinary. And also, share a few insights about Piek the person. There's some good tales. And again, Peter Robinson, who did spend time with him, wrote for the Intercooler about Piek. So there are some interesting quotes that I want to share. But, I mean, some of the feuds. So Porsche's attempted takeover of Volkswagen, 15 or so years ago.
Wendling Wiedeking.
Yeah, Wendling Wiedeking, the Porsche's ambitious CEO, overreached, building up a 51% stake in VW in the group.
I mean, talk about... this was little Porsche.
Yeah, yeah. It's like us trying to buy the Times.
Yes. It's it is this tiny little private company trying to just somehow swallow one of the largest, most successful companies, and he damn near did it.
So he built up a 51% stake in VW, but loading Porsche with debt just as the economy turned sour in 2008.
Yeah.
And it was then that the VW, led by Piek, flipped the deal on its head, and VW absorbed Porsche into its portfolio.
Yeah.
So that was a huge victory for Piek. And the amazing thing about all of this is that Piek is a Porsche.
Yeah.
Isn't that just amazing?
Yeah.
That is extraordinary.
Absolutely. And Wiedeking was, had to leave the business.
Yeah.
I think the severance package was considerable, so I don't imagine anybody will be feeling too sorry for him. But I can remember at the time, because I was knocking about, thinking, how can this happen?
Yeah.
How can Porsche take over Volkswagen? But honestly, someone like Peter Robinson would be the best person to say. But it came so close to happening. And then Piek turned on his head.
It all came to an end for Piek, professionally speaking, in April 2015.
Oh, we're going to do Winterkorn now, aren't we?
Yes, Martin Winterkorn. Well, I mean, do you want to take on the tale if you're familiar with it?
Well, only that, it came to a him or me decision at the top level of the supervisory board, who was going to run the company, who was going to be the company. It was either going to be Martin Winterkorn or it was going to be Piek. And I think to Piek's absolute astonishment, they said Winterkorn.
Yeah, the board voted Winterkorn.
And Piek left. And that seemed to be it.
Mm.
But Piek had one last little laugh stashed up his sleeve, which is that when Dieselgate broke, all the rumours are that the person who went to the authorities and said Winterkorn knew all about this was Piek. Mm. And that was the end of Winterkorn. So, he basically, they both went down. So, Piek went down, but he took Winterkorn with him.
There was an extraordinary, an article that Bob Lutz wrote for Road and Track. This was published in 2015. And I'm suggesting nothing. This is... Bob Lutz wrote this. He said that Ferdinand Piek, the immensely powerful former chief of Volkswagen Supervisory Board, is more than likely the root cause of the VW diesel emissions scandal. He says, now, whether or not he actually knew the ins and outs of it is up for debate. But he thinks it was almost certainly Piek who created the culture within the VW group that led to the diesel emission cheating scandal. And Lutz shares these stories about Piek being utterly ruthless and merciless with his staff, his engineering staff in particular. And certainly Lutz is absolutely convinced that he is ultimately responsible for that, which was a huge, huge scandal.
I think there's so much truth in that. And I can say that because you can't slander the dead.
No,
my understanding of what fundamentally lay behind Dieselgate were that there were engineers who didn't dare say, we can't do this, because of the culture that Piek had instilled there. They were being asked to produce cars that were compliant, but which showed no degradation in performance, and they couldn't do it. And because no one could turn, no one would say around and go, sorry, guys, I know what you want, but it just can't be done. They thought, well, we'll just do this instead, and then no one will ever know. And I think that, no one will ever be able to prove that one led directly to the other. But we do know that it all stemmed from the culture that existed at Volkswagen at the time. And if Piek didn't put that there, who did? And I think that all the other people, you know, people, guys like, you know, Rupert Stadler, who was the head of Audi, you know, who spent a bit of time behind bars, and Winterkorn, and, you know, guys like that, they are all products of that approach. And it was, you know, got a lot of good stuff done, but clearly it was a very, very flawed approach, and yeah, it eventually turned around and, I mean, did just unbelievable damage to the brand.
And cost billions as well. So Piëch, if you read up about him, you'll find endless tales of him being difficult to deal with and certainly to work for. He had either 12 or 13 children from several relationships.
Yes, I was going to say, what does he share in common with Boris Johnson? Nobody's quite sure how many children he's got.
It does say something, doesn't it? It does say something.
At least 12 children from at least four different mothers.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Again, Robbo, Peter Robinson, he wrote about Piëch. Meeting royalty couldn't be this intimidating. I'm beginning to wonder if anyone who works for Ferdinand Piëch has ever had a beer with the bloke. Here at the 1998 Geneva Motor Show, it seems everybody is terrified of the formidable Volkswagen chairman. He goes on to say, he was the most bizarre and complex personality I ever interviewed, and the most intriguing. He calls him an engineering genius, which is fair enough, but also an egomaniac, despotic executive, and above all, a true visionary. Robbo says that he believes that at the core of Piëch's ambition, he was driven by a basic need to match the fame and achievements of his grandfather. He says, I've no doubt Piëch succeeded.
I think that's a great insight. I really do.
Yeah. Piëch's management style was not to motivate, but to use his enormous power to get what he wanted. Throughout his career as CEO of Audi and then VW, he fired numerous executives or force them to resign in frustration. We're not going to see his like again, are we?
I think that culturally it's, well, you say that. Musk?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's a sort of, it's not a direct parallel, but
yeah,
I mean, right. You know, Musk is still quite, well, I don't know how old Musk is, but, you know, who knows what he is yet to do.
He's got a few kids as well.
And he's got a few kids, and he is this sort of Svengali type figure who has found a new way to do it. So maybe.
Wow.
I don't know, it's fascinating. I mean, you know, you think of Elon Musk and all his, you know, fairly, what's the word, interesting utterances on the media platform formerly known as Twitter, and, you know, the stuff he got involved in. You can't really see Piëch ever getting involved in that sort of stuff. But I think there is some parallel with this total single-minded vision and this approach and this, the self-belief and the inconceivability that you could be anything other than completely right about everything.
It's the same.
I think that they share. I was going to, when he died, I was plucking up the courage. I might have even asked the question. I never met the bloke, never said a word to him, but I wanted to interview him just about the 917. I must know, because I can remember having a conversation with somebody at Volkswagen, a Volkswagen AG, saying, that's pretty much the only way you'll get to talk to him now. Because if you just say, you know, I want to talk to you about, you know, Volkswagen.
Product strategy.
He's probably be interested. Yeah. But I said, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to talk about, you know, anything else. I want to talk to him about one car. And they went, yeah, maybe you'd do that. And nothing came of it, sadly. It's one of those things that you sort of say, and, you know, nothing happens. I didn't chase it, and then he died very suddenly, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, unexpectedly. 3-4 years ago. Well, we've run out of time, but what a fascinating guy, Ferdinand Carl Piëch. A hell of a life that man lived. His achievements were really second to none, actually. But wow. What a character.
Can't, You can't imagine going out of the town with them, though, can you?
No. No, it's a very interesting point. Was he driven by something quite dark and pernicious? And was there joy in his life? I don't know. You don't hear many stories of him...
No.
Hanging about laughing and having a great crack with mates.
When you say many, I think you can remove the M from that word.
Yeah.
None at all. Certainly none that I've heard. I've never heard anything, not one thing about him, which suggests he had any kind of sense of humour. He may well have had recreational pursuits, but I suspect he took all of those pretty seriously. That fun was a word which meant anything to him at all.
Mm.
A totally driven man. But I suspect you could say the same about, you know, Enzo Ferrari.
Mm. Yeah, plenty of others. Yeah. Mm. Do you know, we're going to have to do Enzo Ferrari soon. Do one of these topics, these podcasts on Enzo Ferrari, because again, another extraordinary character like Piëch. And actually, to all of you listening, if there is one individual that you want to hear more about, get in touch, let us know. And if there's a great tale behind it, we'll get stuck in. But for now, thank you ever so much for listening. And please remember to tune back in next week.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.